This podcast contains adult content.
Some of the themes or topics may include
information on murder, kidnapping,
torture, dismemberment,
maybe some demonic content,
with information on possessions
and paranormal activity.
This podcast will also include explicit,
horrible and foul,
socially unacceptable,
totally uninhibited,
adult themes language.
So if you're easily offended,
if you're easily triggered,
then I highly suggest you turn this off now, and if not, just keep in mind,
parental discretion is advised.
Welcome to this episode of Mysterious Circumstances Podcast. I'm your host, Justin. Welcome to 2024, where I'm going to be getting on a regular schedule again. Ye fucking ha. Today we're going to be talking about the 1945 murder of Charles Walton, also known as the Witchcraft Murder. But before we do that, I do have a bunch of Patreon subscribers to thank. So, start off with Mothman Farms, Rhiannon McCord, Dustin Anderson, Davis, Carolyn Coleman, Katie, Patrice Villery, Karen Sassy. It's either Sass or Sassy. I am super fucking sorry if I mispronounced that. Last name, we got Catherine Mendenhall, Matthew, and that is about it. I hope you guys are enjoying that extra content that I got on the Patreon feed. I think we're up to about 150 episodes, 140 episodes, something like that. If anybody else is interested in subscribing, you can go to patreon.com/mysterious circumstances. Scroll through, see if there's some things you like. It's only $2 a month. You get access to everything. It's probably one of the cheaper Patreon subscriptions out there for sure. I just uploaded, I think, like 2 episodes the other day, and they're just, each episode is 2 small paranormal cases and then 2 small unsolved deaths. But yeah, got a live show coming up May 18th, 2024 with Brohio Podcast. That'll be at the Boone County Jail Distillery in Lebanon, Indiana. It's just west of Indy, maybe like an hour west of Indy. But yeah, it is legitimately an old jail that they turned into a distillery. It's going to be badass. It's going to be a long show. Tickets are on sale now. I think there's only 25 left. We're only selling 50. They're going pretty fast. So if you want to jump on that, you can go down to the episode description or the podcast description, and I'll have a link right there, and you can just hit it. If not, you can just Google it, and it'll come up in your search bar. With all that behind us, let's go ahead and get on with the show.
In 1945, on the slopes of Nian Hill, an event took place which brought witchcraft into the national dailies. A particularly gruesome murder was committed, which soon became known as the Witchcraft Murder.
All right, this murder happened on February 14th, Valentine's Day, 1945. Let's talk a little bit about Charles Walton. He was 74 years old at the time of his death. He was born in May of 1870. Despite needing a stick to walk because he had arthritis, he was still fit and a very active guy. He was widowed in 1927, and he lived with his adult niece by the name of Edith, who was 33 at the time. He and his wife had adopted Edith when she was 3 when her mother died, which was Charles' sister. They lived in a small cottage in the village of Lower Quinton in Warwickshire. Walton lived in this cottage since World War I, and he had lived in the village his entire life. Walton had given Edith £1 per week for housekeeping, and he also paid the 3 shillings per week rent on the cottage, as well as buying their coal and their meat. And I'll break down the pounds and shillings, how all that works here a little bit later in the episode, because money is a factor in this death. So in addition to his casual earnings, which was from random farmhand work, Walton received 10 shillings a week for old age pension. Edith worked as a print assistant at the Royal Society of Arts, which had relocated to the village during World War II. It's said that Charles Walton was a popular and well-liked member of the community, although some people thought he was a little eccentric, and some people were also suspicious of him, but he was also respected, even by the people who, you know, kind of were suspicious of him. And it was well known in the village that there was something peculiar about Charles Walton. He was described as something of a loner who had earned a reputation as a trainer of horses in his youth. It is said that he did not socialize with his neighbors very much, but that he was not disliked. And on the day of his death, on February 14th, he had got up early that morning, which was routine. He would get up early every day. The young guys were still at war, and there was lots of shit to do around the village. So, you know, he was fit, he was active, he was helping out. He had worked on local farms since he had left school. And for the past 9 months, Charles had been working at the Furze Farm for a guy named Alfred Potter. So, let's jump on into this timeline here. On February 14th, 1945, at 9 a.m., he leaves his cottage. He heads through the local churchyard to cut some hedges at the hill ground on the slopes of Meon Hill. Walton left his wallet at home. He took his pitchfork, a billhook, and a piece of fruitcake for his lunch. I'll be honest, man, this dude's living his best life right now, eating fruitcake for lunch, man. Sounds really good. So shortly after Walton left for Meon Hill, Edith went to work in the local factory that she worked at. Between 9 a.m. and 9:30 a.m., he was witnessed walking through the churchyard. At 6 p.m., Edith Walton arrived home from work, and she was surprised that her uncle wasn't home yet. Walton was expected to be home by about 4 p.m., and she knew that he wouldn't be in like a local bar or a local pub or visiting a friend. He was described as a very solitary man. He had his routine, he had his habits, and he always returned home at the same time, especially during the winter months when the dark evenings would make it hard to work outside. So she was worried that he might have gotten sick, might have had an accident, something like that. So she goes and runs next door to her neighbor, a guy named Harry Beasley. And the both of them, they start walking to Meon Hill and the Furze Farm. Now on their way, they stop to get the farmer, Alfred Potter. Like I said, Alfred Potter was the owner of the Furze Farm and Walton's employer that day, and he had not seen him either. But he said he had noticed a distant figure that morning on the hillside, whom he had assumed to be Walton because he seemed to be cutting hedges. So now that Potter knows what's going on, he's worried too. So he joins Harry Beasley and Edith, and they start walking towards the hill. They're all carrying torches and shit, because it's pretty much darkness outside. And they walked up to the hill to the point where Walton had last been seen, and after a short search of the area, the group came across Charles Walton's body. And without hesitation, Edith began screaming. She just totally lost her shit. So Beasley tries to console her and make sure that she didn't, like, walk too close to the scene. And at that moment, another guy named Harry Peachy was walking along the other side of the hedge. So Alfred Potter calls out to him, and he's like, pointing at the body. He's like, hey, you know, you need to go get the cops, dude. So by about 7 p.m., the police had been informed of Walton's murder, and Potter stood guard over the murder scene until the police arrived, and this is while Beasley had taken Edith back down the hill. At 7:05 p.m., the first policeman on the scene arrived, and it was Police Constable Michael James Lomasny. Members of Stratford Avon CID arrived a little later in the evening, while Professor James M. Webster of the West Midlands Forensic Lab arrived at about 11:30 p.m., and the body was removed at 1:30 a.m. the following morning. Let's talk about why Edith completely lost her mind when she saw the crime scene. When they found Charles, he was laying there dead, next to the hedge that he had been trimming. The ground around him was covered in blood. Charles had been beaten with his own walking stick. The walking stick was found 3.5 yards from his body with blood and hair still stuck to it. A big cross was carved into his chest. His neck had been slashed with a billhook, and it was slashed so deep it almost decapitated him, and it was still stuck in his neck at the time. The pitchfork was used to pin him to the ground, also in the neck area, and it was pinned so deep that it took 2 men to pull it out. So Professor Webster concluded that Walton's wounds had been caused by 2 weapons, a stabbing weapon and a cutting weapon, presumably the pitchfork and the slash hook. And the only thing missing from Charles Walton was his old tin pocket watch, which wasn't even worth any money, really. It was a junk old tin pocket watch. So the first medical observations were made by Dr. A.R. McWinney, who had a private practice in Stratford. And the postmortem was done by Professor Webster from the West Midlands Forensic Laboratory. Here's Dr. McWinney's notes when he documented the murder. And this is all quoted. The body was lying on its left side, with the knees and hips in a bent position. There was a gash on the right side of the neck involving the main structures of the neck, and the cut ends of main vessels and the lacerated windpipe could be seen. The tip of a billhook was buried at least 4 inches in the tissue at the front of the neck. In addition, the face was impaled by a pitchfork. One prong entered on either side of the face just below and in front of the angle of the jaw. The handle of the fork had been pressed backwards, and the end of the handle was wedged under the cross member of the hedge behind the head, thus anchoring the head to the ground. The autopsy report later revealed that the murderer had also beaten Charles over the head with his own stick, and that he had numerous other injuries, including multiple bruises, a severed clavicle, and broken ribs, and his trachea had been cut. Walton's shirt had been opened, his trousers had been unfastened at the top, and his fly was unbuttoned. Now, despite persistent reports that a cross had been carved into Charles's chest, which would suggest a ritualistic murder, the detailed report makes no such claim. There's no observation in there at all. Walton also had defensive wounds. He had a cut on his left hand and bruises on the back of his right hand and forearm, which means he had absolutely fought for his life. It was determined that Walton died between 1 and 2 p.m. on February 14th. Now let's talk about the investigation. Local police called in Scotland Yard, which was known as the Metropolitan Police. They called in for help. This was common in the 1940s. Some reports say it was because of the nature of the crime. I could see it going both ways, to be honest with you. So on February 15th, the Deputy Chief Constable of Warwickshire sent a message which stated, "The Chief Constable has asked me to get the assistance of Scotland Yard to assist in a brutal case of murder that took place yesterday. The deceased is a man named Charles Walton, age 75, and he was killed with an instrument known as a slash hook. The murder was either committed by a madman or one of the Italian prisoners who are in a camp nearby. The assistance of an Italian interpreter would be necessary. I think Dr. Webster states the deceased was killed between 1 and 2 p.m. yesterday. A metal watch is missing from the body. It is being circulated." So by the following day, one of England's best detectives took over the case, and his name was Robert Fabian. Along with his assistant, Sergeant Albert Webb, they met with Detective Inspector Alex Spooner, who was a local Warwickshire policeman. They start the hunt for the killer, and they do a very methodical and detailed investigation into the murder. The investigation was actually the final case for Fabian, who was going to be retiring soon. Fabian was an aging celebrity detective, though, and he had a lot of media hype behind him saying that he was the living version of Sherlock Holmes. And because of him, Lower Quinton gained a whole new level of media attention. Newspapers love turning the story of Charles Walton's death into a murder mystery about old-fashioned rural people who worshipped a sun god. The local paper called the Coventry Telegraph referred to this case as a whodunit witchcraft murder. The next step was a ground search, which was carried out by local officers, with help from soldiers of the Royal Engineers with metal detectors. They were looking for Walton's pocket watch, and it had been discovered that it was the only thing missing, which Walton had always carried in his waistcoat. So Fabian thought it was really odd because the watch was a super cheap one. It was made of tin, but he hoped that if they found it, it would have fingerprints of the killer. They did an intensive search of the area, and the watch was not found. The details of the watch were passed to pawnbrokers and jewelers. They described it as gents plain white metal pocket watch, snap case at back, white enamel face, with Edgar Jones Stratford on Avon engraved into it. It was secondhand, English numerals, valued at 25 shillings about 10 years ago. So after discussing different aspects of the murder, Fabian, Webb, and Spooner started speculating as to what kind of person would have committed this crime. Sergeant Webb was a very hardened, very experienced London officer, and he immediately suggested that it was the work of a maniac. Who else would attack and mutilate an old and defenseless farm worker? And of course, Fabian agreed. I'm pretty sure we all can agree with that, right? Then the 493 inhabitants of the village all received a visit from Fabian and Webb and were asked to account for their movements on the day of the murder. There were about 4,000 statements taken, and traveling people were traced and interviewed as far away as Somerset and Yorkshire. 29 samples of hair, blood, and clothing were analyzed, and every avenue was explored. Fabian eventually met a wall of silence in town because all the villagers were being uncooperative. One man was overheard saying that Walton was dead and buried, so there was nothing to worry about. Now, usually people want to help the police, especially if a victim is vulnerable, but local people avoided participation in the murder investigation, and they seemed unbothered by the fact that there was this maniac, potentially on the loose, running around, that killed one of their own local citizens in this village. And Fabian commented that when he tried to interview the people in the village, they would lower their eyes and they were reluctant to speak except for when they would talk about the bad crops. And they also would talk about a heifer that had died in a ditch recently. So the cops are frustrated, and Fabian started to believe he would never solve the case until the local detective, Alex Spooner, started talking about a theory, and this changed the entire direction of the case. So Detective Inspector Alex Spooner was a local guy, which meant he had detailed knowledge of that local area, and he immediately recognized the ritualistic nature of the murder of Charles Walton. He also understood that the area around Meon Hill was rich with stories about witchcraft and the occult. And Spooner drew Fabian's attention to a book on local folklore. It was called Folklore, Old Customs, and Superstitions in Shakespeareland, and it was written by J. Harvey Bloom, who was a local vicar, in 1929. From what I saw, it was first published in 1930. Spooner had underlined a passage in the book which told of how, in 1875, a weak-minded young man killed a woman named Ann Turner with a hay fork because he believed she had bewitched him. We'll talk more about all that a little bit later. But further on in the book, another page had been marked. The story told of how in 1885, a plowboy by the name of Charles Walton had encountered a large black dog 9 days in a row while on his way home from work. On the very last occasion, the dog supposedly turned into a headless woman, and we will also talk more about that later when we get into some of the theories and stuff like that. So by the time Fabian had finished reading all of this, he had to acknowledge that Charles Walton may have been murdered because he was a practicing witch, and not for some old cheap tin watch that he had. Fabian reluctantly turned to that witchcraft theory and discovered that according to the old Julian calendar in use until the Middle Ages, February 14th actually fell on February 2nd, which according to local superstition was traditionally the best day for a blood sacrifice. At this point of the year, the earth was just beginning to recover from the winter, and a ritual sacrifice was seen as a way to ensure a good harvest that year. One of the last lines of inquiry was about Walton's past, but nothing was really found there except for the strange disappearance of Walton's money. When Walton's wife had died in 1927, she left him a sum of £297, which in today's money in US dollar would be about $5,500. And this was a pretty considerable amount of money for the time. He was known to have placed it in a building society, but when police investigated, the balance was only £2.11. And just so we know, 1 shilling is 1/20th of a pound, so there's 20 shillings in a pound. It was estimated that his weekly bills were no more than £2 per week, and he had worked all his life and been very frugal, so he had saved a lot of money, and he was still making money on top of that. Police did find 60 shillings in his house, but the remainder of his money was never accounted for, and no explanation was ever given for its disappearance. Other inquiries of the Midland Bank revealed that Walton had deposited £227.10 in June of 1930, but that by 1939, his money had dwindled down to £11.11.09, and there are 240 pence in a pound. So Walton had made numerous withdrawals during the years in between those 9 years, but there was never a withdrawal bigger than £10. So now that we know Charles Walton, we know the scene of the crime, we know a little bit of local lore, which we're going to talk about more later, let's talk about some facts and theories now. So we're going to go from kind of least plausible to most plausible, kind of. So the first one is a POW. Close to Lower Quinton was an Italian prisoner of war camp. As the war was coming to a close, the prisoners were given just a super huge level of freedom. They were used as cheap labor on local farms, and the prisoners were allowed to travel to and from their place of work unsupervised. On the afternoon of the day of the murder, some prisoners had gone into Stratford to see a play, while others had gone to the movies. Within days, an arrest was made. An Italian prisoner of war from a nearby camp at Long Marston had been seen hiding in a ditch on Meon Hill with blood on his hands. After questioning, they found out the man was just a poacher who had regularly escaped from the camp to supplement his diet with a few rabbits. He was returned to the camp, and he was not charged, so they kept on searching. Now, if one of the POWs came upon Charles as he worked alone and murdered him, the only thing missing from Walton's body was a cheap tin pocket watch. And I don't think any of them are going to risk murdering this dude in such a brutal fucking manner, or at all for that matter, over a worthless watch. Next person we got is George Higgins. He was 72 years old at the time. He was from Fairview, Lower Quinton. He was employed by Mr. Vallander of Upper Quinton. He was a best friend of Charles Walton and was working in a barn less than 300 yards from where his body was found. A rumor had it that the old men had a falling out right around Christmas time, you know, a couple, like a month, month and a half, 2 months before. And Fabian speculated that Higgins could have made his way across the fields unseen and killed Walton, but he doubted that a 72-year-old man would have had the strength to just mount such an attack on somebody. I mean, it was a brutal, brutal attack, and there was really no motive, you know? I mean, yeah, they had a falling out, but how many times you argue with your friends and, you know, you go over and kill them? You know, it's a rare occasion. One of the next theories is that it was a ritual murder. Margaret Murray, who was 87 years old. She was the author of the popular but much maligned book called The Witch Cult in Western Europe, A Study in Anthropology. She believed the Walton murder was more than likely a ritual act performed with the purpose of replenishing the soil. Darren Charles, a historian from the Folk Horror Revival Project, touched on some of the wilder rumors that circulated, and he says, apparently the year before Walton's death proved to be a difficult harvest, and the beer brewed from those crops was undrinkable. Walton was seen as an unusual fellow who had bred natterjack toads in his garden and tamed wild dogs with just his voice. This might sound far-fetched as a motive for murder, but Darren Charles says it was much more logical in the context of the time. It's a remote region reconnecting with its ancient superstitions because of the dread and fears of World War II. Some of these locals were unsure of the future, so they started looking backwards outside of the Christian church for philosophical guidance, and this was just more appealing to them instead of the whole Christianity thing. Also, by where Walton's body was found is the Rollright Stones, and it's an ancient stone monument, and the Burr Hill Iron Age Hill Fort, which give the whole region just a sense of being ancient, magical, strange. Another person, Maria J. Perez Cuervo, who's a writer specializing in archaeology, insists these stories were also being told when Walton was alive in the 1930s and early 40s. She said, the link between rural communities, pagan beliefs, and ritual sacrifice was very much in the zeitgeist when Walton was murdered, largely due to the popularity of the Golden Bough by Sir James Frazer. She says, Frazer has traced a common template for a series of myths and rituals from around the world, concluding that they were part of a widespread belief in a solar god king whose ritual killing ensured the fertility of the land and who would be reborn again in the spring to start a new cycle. His work suggested that the apparently inoffensive rituals performed in remote rural corners in Britain were actually pagan survivals. This proved inspiring for many authors working on genre fiction, and also had an impact on the way Walton's murder was reported, and therefore in how the case is remembered now. So the two reports that Fabian wrote on the case in 1945, and which are preserved on the police file, make no mention of witchcraft, ritualistic killing, black dogs, natterjack toads, or blood sacrifices. And remember that. He wrote these reports, and he never mentioned anything about witchcraft, ritualistic killing, black dogs, natterjack toads, or blood sacrifices. Those are in the police files that he did, the two reports. That's important later when we go down. But 25 years later, he wrote the following that said, I advise anybody who is tempted at any time to venture into black magic, witchcraft, shamanism, call it what you will, to remember Charles Walton and to think of his death, which was clearly the ghastly climax of a pagan rite. There is no stronger argument for keeping as far away as possible from the villains with their swords, incense, and mumbo-jumbo. It is prudence on which your future peace of mind and even your life could depend. So, you got a pretty far cry, you know, from his police reports in 1945 to what he wrote 25 years later. And to be honest, like, when you're writing shit in a report, especially at that time, you know, out of London, Scotland Yard, I mean, would you put that kind of shit in a report, though? Because you're going to get ostracized, probably made fun of. It's hard telling. That's all speculation on my behalf, but pretty big difference there. Among the theories and rumors that surrounded this case in subsequent years are that it was claimed that locals believed that Walton was a witch whose powers were feared by some of the villagers. And two examples cited were the failure of the 1944 harvest and the death of Potter's heifer on the day before, which would have been February 13th. It was claimed that this alleged witchcraft led him to be murdered in a ritualistic manner which involved his blood soaking into the ground to replenish the soil's fertility. Criminology professor David Wilson very much agrees with that assessment, referencing Dennis Wheatley's 1934 novel, The Devil Rides Out, as another example of a horror story that kind of lurked in the public subconscious around the time of the murder. The number one suspect regarding Walton's death, Alfred Potter, was a farmer that was involved in a financial dispute with Walton. So David Wilson says, "The simplest solutions are usually the best, and I believe the true culprit, Potter, alluded to a number of local witchcraft conspiracies to lay a false trail." And a lot of that, Wilson states, you know, it helped the media kind of influence the case as well. He also says, here was this rural backwater, so of course the media was going to be interested in stirring up witchcraft, headless horsemen, and occultism. Because the media was metropolitan and quote-unquote enlightened, they preyed on the cliches of locality. The whole idea of evil lurking in these tiny, beautiful hamlets was a trope that existed very heavily across the 1940s and even past that. And you could say Detective Fabian got too lost in the noise. That's probably the biggest factor to why it remained unsolved. You heard David Wilson, you know, say that. That was a quoted phrase. There is a good reason that Fabian got lost in the noise. And again, we'll talk about that here in a little bit. In the BBC documentary, The Power of the Witch, Walton's own niece describes what was reported in the press as witchcraft being ridiculous and none of it was true. The date of Walton's murder, February 14th, was the date that ancient druids allegedly made blood sacrifice rituals for good crops, in the belief that if life force is taken out of the earth, it must be returned. The crops of 1944 were really bad. In the spring of 1945, it wasn't looking much better either. And Walton was known to harness his huge toads to toy plows and send them running into the fields. Why this is interesting is because I've done an episode on Isabel Gowdy. You can go back and listen to that. I think it was a two-parter. In 1662, the Scottish witch, Isabel Gowdy, confessed to doing the exact same thing in order to blast the crops. And maybe someone thought Walton was using witchcraft to blast his neighbor's crops as well. Now, significantly, Walton's blood had been allowed to drain into the ground. Now, according to old beliefs, a witch's power could be neutralized by blooding, which is literally just letting the blood run all the way out. Many accused witches bled to death from cutting and slashing, usually done to the forehead. The practice was done in certain parts of England from the 16th century up to the 19th century. So, pretty weird shit, right? And it gets a lot better, too. But before we go any further, let's go ahead and take a small commercial break. You guys know the routine. You can either fast forward, you can sit through it, grab yourself another drink, whatever the case might be. I'll meet you back here in a few minutes. So going in with the ritualistic murder type theory, we've come to the point where Charles Walton may have been a cunning man. Charles Walton was unlikely to be the devil-worshipping witch that some accused him of being, but there is a very strong possibility he was one of the last cunning folk practicing low magic in 1940s Britain. As a cunning man, Walton would have been very respected in his community. Now, there's few areas of Britain that have a deeper association with traditional witchcraft than Warwickshire. And privately, it was accepted that Walton was involved with the various covens operating in the area. Now, despite this, it seems that Walton had few, if any, enemies, and most of the village was friendly with him. A cunning man would have a deep understanding of folk magic, cures, and medicine. He would use this knowledge and skills to combat evil spirits and bad witchcraft. He would also heal the sick and offer charms and spells for a small fee. Cunning folk were predominantly male and were seen as useful people with a deep understanding of the countryside and an affinity with nature. They were valued in the villages of rural Britain. He was very well versed in country lore. He seemed to know a lot about the old ways of the countryside. Charles Walton was also rumored to have many, many gifts. He was widely known to have clairvoyant powers and also have lesser control over animals. It was claimed he could talk to birds and direct them to go wherever he wanted simply by pointing, and they would eat from his hand without fear, except dogs. He feared dogs. He also bred large toads, which were called natterjack toads. And during a search of his residence after the murder, there were a number of natterjack toads found kept in the garden, and according to the Annals of British Witchcraft, they were creatures used to blight crops since the 16th century. So why would anyone want to murder the old man in such a ritualistic manner? And that answer might be in a rumor that had made the rounds of the village where he lived in the months before his death. One local kid reported he had seen Walton harness a toad to a mini toy plow, which meant he was cursing the crops and cursing the earth. Basically everything that this toad and this mini plow touched, it would curse the crops. Charles Walton had been accused of blasting by some of the local villagers, and blasting was a form of witchcraft used to hex crops and livestock. Lower Quinton had suffered a dreadful harvest in the year before Walton's death, so it was not really surprising that he became the subject of the local gossip. Now, the ritual of blasting involved driving natterjack toads across the land to strip it of all the good things. The garden of Walton's cottage was overrun with these toads, and one villager even claimed that old Charlie kept a toy plow to which he harnessed the creatures before they did his bidding. And in the days before Walton's death, two heifers had been discovered dead. Did one of the local farmers believe the hex was on them again? Yeah, that's a fucking possibility. Charles was killed using a method traditionally used to murder those suspected of witchcraft. Walton was stanged, which S-T-A-N-G-E-D. It's either stanged or stanged. That meant his neck was slashed and his body pinned down by a pitchfork to prevent him from rising from the dead. His blood was left to drain into the ground and replenish the soil that he had cursed. Pretty interesting shit, huh? Yeah. Next one up is the mysterious Meon Hill. As far back as living memory, the hill and its residents have been associated with occult and black magic rituals. Its very existence is said to have been the result of a row between the devil and the monks from nearby Evesham Abbey. One version of the story has an irate devil kicking a boulder at the abbey in a bid to destroy it. His plan was thwarted by the power of prayer, and the boulder fell to the ground as Clevedon Hill. Another twist on the legend has him throwing a lump of earth, and again the power of prayer shielded the newly built abbey, and the clod fell to earth as Meon Hill. Now, the Celts who occupied the area centuries before believed that Meon Hill was the resting place of Aran, the god of the underworld. Aran was guarded by a pack of spectral black dogs who went hunting with him as he searched for unsuspecting mortals to populate his kingdom. To this very day, witnesses claim to encounter black dogs on Meon Hill all the time. They are known as a harbinger of death and destruction, and the legend of black dogs was to have particular significance in Charles Walton's life. And if you remember my Appalachian Stories episode, we talk about black dogs in there as well. So there are a lot of weird stories associated with Meon Hill. It rises above the hamlet of Upper Quinton and the flat of Avon Plain. And down at its foundation, which are rippling, are ancient ridge and furrow fields, and at the top is an Iron Age fort. It's 637 feet high. Its summit is often swirled by clouds and stuff like that. So let's talk about these black dogs and the ghostly ladies. So one of the stories recounted in the book given to Fabian by Spooner features the story of a young boy called Charles Walden. The story takes place in the area where the murdered Charles Walden lived and puts him at the right age in 1885 to be the boy in the book. On 8 consecutive nights, 14-year-old Charles Walden encountered a ghostly black dog on his way home from the farm where he was working. When Charles told the farmer, he scoffed at him and told him to try to forget what he had seen. Walden was unable to do this because the dog appeared once more, for the 9th day and the final time. This time the dog walked quietly next to him for a few minutes before slowly transforming into a woman. The woman wore a black silk dress and a hooded cape. When she pulled down her hood, she appeared completely headless. So Walden, who was terrified, ran home only to find out that his sister was dying from a sudden unknown illness. From that time onwards, some of the young Walton's neighbors were suspicious that he had strange powers gifted by the devil, which allowed him to predict the future and practice witchcraft. And that is why they thought of Charles Walden in the village as a cunning man. The legend of the black dog also played a very eerie part in Fabian's investigation. In the first few days of the investigation, a police car hit and killed a black dog. Later that day, a similar black dog was found hanging from a tree branch by its collar, close to where Walton's body was found. Fabian also recounts seeing a black dog himself while he searched for clues at the murder site. Shortly afterwards, a young boy came up the hill, and he seemed to be looking for something. Fabian asked whether he had lost his dog or not. The boy looked at him kind of puzzled, and Fabian explained that he had just seen a large black hound, and when he did, that boy turned completely pale white, and he took this huge breath and he ran as fast as he could down the hill. And it should be noted that this time of the year was the Roman feast of Lupercalia, when dogs were sacrificed to ensure good crops. So why would there be a dead black hound hanging by its collar near the site where Charles Walton's body was found and he was bled out and killed in a way that is traditionally used to kill witches? It's pretty interesting, huh? Now let's talk about this other similar murder that happened in 1875. So on September 15th, 1875, at about 8 o'clock in the evening, a woman named Anne Tennant, who was either 79 or 80 years old, she left her house to buy a loaf of bread. She was a resident of Long Compton, which was about 15 miles from Lower Quinton. On her way back, she met some farm workers returning home from harvesting in the fields. One of the group was a local man named James Hayward. He had known Anne's family for many, many years. Hayward was very simple-minded, and he was kind of seen as the village idiot. And it is known that he was also drinking cider that night, so he was probably a little drunk. But as they were walking by, without warning, he attacked Ann Tennant with a pitchfork, stabbing her in the legs and head. A local farmer named John Taylor heard what was going on, and he ran to try to help Ann. And he ended up restraining Hayward until a constable arrived. And Anne was taken to her daughter's house but died of her injuries around 11:15 p.m. that night, roughly 3 hours after the attack. Hayward claimed that Anne was a witch and that there were other witches in the village whom he intended to deal with in the very same way. So when asked for his motive, John Hayward accused Anne Tennant of being a witch who had put the evil eye on him. And according to him, she was not the only witch in the area, and if he had the opportunity, he would have killed all of them if he could. He thought he was acting for the good of the whole community, because Ann Turner had bewitched the cattle and the land of local farmers. And that's literally a quote from him. he said that he had pinned her to the ground with a hay fork before slashing her throat with a billhook in the form of a cross. It was believed that this was the only way to prevent the dead witch from rising to the grave. He ended up going on trial, and he was found not guilty of murder on the grounds of insanity and spent the rest of his life in Broadmoor Criminal Lunatic Asylum. He is recorded as dying there at the age of 59 in the first half of 1890. A report in the Stratford Herald described the event. On the night in question, between 7 and 8 o'clock, the poor old woman left her cottage for the purpose of going to a small shop in the village for a loaf of bread. On her return, she met Hayward, who had just left his work in the harvest fields and who, without a word on either side, attacked Mrs. Tennant with a fork which he was carrying, inflicting such injuries upon her head and body that she died in the course of 3 hours. In fact, had it not been for the assistance of Mr. John Taylor, a farmer who resided near where the attack took place, he would have killed her on the spot. The only reason that can be assigned for the murder is that Hayward, for some time past, had been under the impression that he was influenced by witchcraft, and that Mrs. Tennant and several other women in Long Compton were witches, and he was determined to rid the village of them. In his book in 1906, Clive Holland, in his account of the Tennant murder, explained that using a pitchfork in killing a witch was a relic of the old Anglo-Saxon stockung, or sticking. It was believed to be the only effective way to kill a witch and neutralize any curses or spells. Holland points to the eerie confession given by murderer Hayward, where he said, "I pinned her to the ground with a hay fork before slashing her throat with a billhook in the form of a cross." And although the courts did find Hayward insane and locked him away for life, he was not on his own with these beliefs. Reporting on the Walton case, the Illustrated Police News said, "It was proved in evidence that fully one-third of the villagers believed in witchcraft." Then, on February 13, 1954, the eve of the 9th anniversary of Walton's murder, the Daily Mirror revisited the killing of Ann Tennant and the alleged similarity between that event and Walton's murder. The report said, "The police have found one other link between the killings, but I am pledged not to reveal it." Whew, that's a lot of stuff going on there, you know? Next up in the theories and everything section, we have an anonymous letter. One of the strangest twists in the murder of Charles Walton was an anonymous letter that was sent first to the police and then to a local newspaper. In the letter, a Wolverhampton woman calling herself Mrs. Jones claimed to have been present when Charles Walton was murdered. The woman suggested that she was part of a coven of witches who gathered together to perform the ritualistic sacrifice. The leader of the coven of witches, she suggested, was the former lover of Aleister Crowley. Crowley was infamous throughout Britain at this time for his occult beliefs and practices and had hundreds of followers across the country. Mrs. Jones's account was discounted as fantasy by the police, but it certainly helped consolidate the belief amongst the public that witchcraft was involved in Walton's murder. Next up, we have a séance that was held. By the early 50s, the murder of Charles Walton remained unsolved, but that did not mean that interest in the case had died down. In 1950, the respected Egyptologist and anthropologist, Dr. Margaret Murray, made a study of the murder. She was masquerading as a tourist enjoying a painting holiday, and she went around and started doing her own line of questioning. And she concluded that Charles's death was almost certainly the consequence of a black magic ritual involving local witches. 2 years later, Mills and Higginbotham from the Birmingham Physical Society held a secret séance on Meon Hill on the anniversary of Walton's death. Now, while the identity of the murderer was not revealed, Walton was rumored to have left the following message: I forgive, I deserved what was coming to me, but not in such a brutal way. Next, we have this really strange finding, and it is that missing watch. The only item missing from Charles Walton's body was that small tin watch, and it wasn't worth shit, and he always carried it with him. Now, Fabian very quickly realized that if he found that watch, it could lead him to the killer, and he organized a huge search of Walton's home to make sure it wasn't there. After a number of searches failed to turn up the watch, Fabian became convinced it had been stolen. In August of 1960, during the demolition of outhouses behind Charles Walton's cottage, a workman saw something shining and he picked it up, and it was found out to be that old tin pocket watch. So later that day, Walton's niece confirmed that it was the missing watch from the day he died, but could give no explanation as to how it had found its way to its hiding place. When they opened the watch case, a small piece of colored glass was found. Walton was known to have carried this around with him, and he never let it out of his possession. The general consensus of opinion among the villagers was that this was a piece of witch glass. Witch glass was used to deflect bad magic away from a person or absorb any negative thoughts toward the owner. If lost, it would always find its way back to the person who it was charged with protecting. The odd thing about this find was that the police had searched the building shortly after the crime and found nothing. So it appears that the killer must have returned at some point later to return the watch. And why had the murderer felt that it was necessary to take such a huge risk in returning this watch, when he could have just as easily thrown it away, buried it, done whatever else with it? But whoever that was felt the need to return it. Now, personally, it's also a possibility that Walton forgot his watch that one day, or he didn't take it with him. That's a possibility as well, obviously. Now on to one of the biggest suspects, and probably the favorite amongst many people, Alfred Potter. He was 40 years old at the time of the murder, and he managed the furs for L.L. Potter & Company, which was a company owned by his father. And he appears to have been the last person to see Walton alive. Potter was working in his own fields that morning and estimated that he had seen Walton on the hillside at around 2 p.m. Now, he just assumed it was Walton because nobody else should have been on his land cutting any hedges. Potter's behavior remained suspicious throughout the investigation. He gave various contradictory accounts of his movements during that day. Potter's demeanor was first noted when the police arrived at the scene. He appeared overly agitated and anxious to leave the scene. When Constable Lemazny arrived at 7:05 p.m., he noted that Potter seemed very upset. He was shivering and complained of being cold. Looking back, I think that Potter appeared more worried than one would have expected him to be. But Potter was also very used to slaughtering animals, so he was probably less affected by the murder scene than a lot of other guys. Constable Lemazny was also surprised when Potter said he was going home before the Stratford police turned up. He said, "His complaint of feeling cold I considered a strange excuse from one who was used to attending to animals at all hours and in all kinds of weather, especially as the murdered man was his own employee and had been murdered on his own land." The Stratford police actually showed up just as Potter was leaving. And one of the most damning pieces of evidence against Potter was his claim that he sometimes paid Charles Walton for hours he had not worked. But in fact, it was the opposite. Apparently, there was a big fight between the two when Walton had discovered that he was underpaying him and he wanted his money. Now, at 11 p.m. on February 14th, Detective Inspector Toombs took a statement from Alfred Potter. Potter stated that he had been in the College Arms with Joseph Stanley, a farmer of Whitecross Farm, until noon that day. He had gone straight across to a small field adjoining Hillground and saw Walton walking about 500 to 600 yards away. He said he noticed that Walton had about 6 to 10 yards of hedge left to cut, and that when he found his body later that day, about 4 additional yards of hedge had been cut, which could be about half an hour's work. Here's my thing with that. How in the actual fuck are you going to be 5 to 600 yards away? Notice a guy, you know, I could see the assumption, you know, with assuming that it's Walton, but you can't fucking tell me that from 5 to 600 yards away, you can look across a field and be like, oh yeah, yeah, I'd say he's got about 6 to 10 yards of hedge left to cut. Yeah, he's about done. It's like, nah, bro, that is a long ways away. I mean, think about it relatively, like that's 5 to 6 football fields, you know. Potter also stated that he knew that it was Walton's habit to stop for lunch around 11 a.m. and that he would then work continuously until about 4 p.m. He described Walton as an inoffensive type of man, but one who would speak his mind if necessary. Potter stated that he had been at the farm for about 5 years and had known Walton for all that time. He had employed Walton casually for the last 9 months and said that Walton had worked when the weather permitted. Walton had been engaged on hedging for the previous few months, and Hillground was the last field needing attention. So a few days later, on February 17th, Potter was interviewed for a second time, but this time by Detective Sergeant Webb. In this instance, Potter said he would have gone over to see Walton at Hillground on February 14th, were it not for the fact that he had a heifer in a ditch nearby that he needed to attend to. He claimed he had gone straight home, arriving there at about 12:40 p.m., and then went to attend to the heifer. However, the heifer was found to have drowned in Doomsday Ditch on February 13th, and was not removed from the furs until 3:30 p.m. on that Valentine's Day, the next day. And this is almost 3 hours after Potter claimed to have gone to attend to it. Potter's statement about the heifer was contradicted by his statement on February 23rd that he had gone home, read the paper, and then helped Charles Batchelor to pulp manigolds. Fabian made a comment that Potter is undoubtedly lying about his actions at this critical time, but the reason for these lies can, for the present, only be a matter for conjecture. Fabian's cynicism about Potter's activities between noon and 12:40 p.m. was increased by the fact that he variously stated he had seen Walton working in the distance at 12:10 p.m., 12:15 p.m., and 12:20 p.m., ultimately telling the inquest that he had seen someone stationary at 12:30 p.m. Fabian commented that, thus we have Potter's story gradually changing from seeing Charles Walton working at hedge cutting at 12:10 p.m. to seeing a man standing stationary in the field at 12:30 p.m. Potter's statements about seeing Walton at work invariably said that he was in his shirt sleeves. But when the body was found, he was wearing a jacket. Underneath his jacket, he was wearing a shirt, but the sleeves were cut off above the elbow. Which means Potter could not have seen Walton in his shirt sleeves. In Fabian's view, even if Potter had merely seen Walton with his jacket off, it seems improbable he would have worked in shirt sleeves at 12:20 and then put his jacket on unless he had decided to go home. Potter stated that Walton had usually worked about 4 days each week, but never in wet weather. He said he paid him 18 pence per hour, which there's 12 pence in a shilling, and he usually paid at the end of each fortnight, although sometimes by the week. He said that he left it to Walton to say how many hours he had completed and implied that Walton was sometimes paid for hours he had not actually worked. He had last paid Walton for the fortnight ending February 10th, when he had given him £2.15. Potter stated that on the day of the murder, he had left the College Arms and gone across to a field known as Cax Leys to see some sheep and to feed some calves. When he reached the field, it was 12:20 p.m., and he then saw Walton working in his shirt sleeves. He was sure of this because it was the first time he had seen him so dressed and had said to himself, "He's getting on with it today." Potter added that he would have gone over to see Walton were it not for the fact that he had a heifer in a ditch nearby that needed attention, right? He went straight home and arrived there at about 12:40 p.m. He then went to attend the heifer. Then on February 20th, Police Constable Lamazny was at the Furs and mentioned the fact that the police were still hoping to take fingerprints from the murder weapons. Potter said he had previously mentioned to the police that he had touched the murder weapons. He said he had touched the handle of the slash hook and possibly the pitchfork when he first came across the body, although he claimed he had already mentioned this to the police. He said he had handled the weapons in response to a comment from Harry Beasley when he said, "You'd better have a look to make sure he is gone." But this was the first time he had made any kind of claim like this to the police. And Beasley strongly denied any question that he had asked Potter to make sure Walton was dead. Beasley said it was obvious that he was dead and that Potter did not touch the weapons in his presence. Beasley said he was confident that Potter realized Walton was dead from the moment he saw Walton's body. When Harry Beasley was interviewed, he said that Potter had a reputation as a decent man to work for. Fabian commented that Potter produced his explanation only when Lamazny asked the question of fingerprints. He considered that Potter had gone to great pains to explain away any of his fingerprints that might be found upon the weapons, but no prints were ever found on these weapons, which suggests that they might have been wiped clean. Mrs. Potter had displayed considerable annoyance at this revelation, stating that the police were bound to suspect him if his prints were on the murder weapon. Alfred Potter, meanwhile, told Lamazny that the murder was the work of a fascist from the camp. A short time later, a serviceman came to the door and asked for Potter, who was in the yard. Lamazny recorded that when Potter came in, he said, "That soldier just told me that the military police at the camp have caught an Italian coming out with a suit of clothes and detained him and sent him for the civil police who came dashing out. They have taken him away with him." Potter affected great happiness, and his wife became almost hysterical with delight. Also on February 20th, after Fabian and Webb had returned to London, the police constable who had relieved Lamazny and stood guard over the murder scene reported that Potter had returned to Hillground soon after first light on February 15th. The policeman warned Potter away from the actual site of the murder. They exchanged a few pleasantries about the coldness of the weather, and Potter had given the constable a player's cigarette and then left. So this revelation brought Fabian and Webb back to another interview with Potter and some questions about why he didn't tell them earlier about visiting the scene the next morning. The police took statements from two former employees of Potter's, William George Dyde and George Purnell. Both confirmed that from time to time, Potter had experienced difficulties in paying their wages. Another guy, Joseph Stanley, confirmed that Potter had assisted him with the castration of two calves on the morning of February 14th, and that they had subsequently visited the College Arms, where Potter had drunk two glasses of Guinness between 11:45 a.m. and noon. Damn, bro. Not to break the tension here, but two glasses of Guinness in 15 minutes, man. God, I'm not a heavy beer guy, so that just amazes me. Just so it's noted, those two employees that I talked about, they ended up fucking quitting. They're like, screw this, dude, we're out of here. And Fabian believed that both of them had possibly realized the nature of the man for whom they were working for. And he also wondered if Batchelor had compromised himself by stating that he had seen Potter at 12:40 p.m. And the key for the police was establishing Potter's movements between 12 noon, when he parted company with Joseph Stanley at the College Arms, and 12:40 p.m., when Charles Batchelor said he saw him at the Furs. So we've got a good 40-minute gap right here. But despite Potter changing his story in various ways, numerous times, Fabian concluded that there was no real evidence to connect him with the murder itself, and no reasonable motive can be found for committing it. Fabian found that there is no evidence that Potter was violent or that he and Walton had ever argued. He described Potter as morose and sullen at his interviews, although even when closely interrogated, he never lost his temper and was civil. He wrote that Potter was unkempt and on the surface dull-witted, and he says, "I am convinced he is far from that." And Fabian stated that he was a man of considerable strength and an extremely cunning individual. Now, although a number of writers have suggested that Walton had lent Potter money and its repayment was overdue, there is no proof that this was the case, and this was vehemently denied by Walton's niece, Edith. Edith claimed that Potter stated the following as they made their way to the Hill Ground with Harry Beasley on the day of the murder. She says that Potter said, "I have to do the milking on a Wednesday. I came to the field to cut some hay at 12 noon and saw your uncle at his work." Then Edith stated that she had never heard Walton say he had ever lent anyone any money, and she had not seen any IOUs. Now, according to Fabian's initial report, Potter stated on the 23rd that after his visit to Caxley, he had come home. He had then asked how long dinner would be, and his wife had replied, "Not long." So when Potter heard this, he had gone to help Batchelor at around 12:40 p.m. and returned at 1:05 p.m. Batchelor also confirmed that Potter had come to help him at about 12:40 p.m., and both men had gone to look at the church clock and saw that it was 1 p.m. So, on February 27th, Fabian asked that inquiries be made to Stubbs and Bradstreet about any debts recorded against Alfred Potter or L.L. Potter & Company, farmers of Camden, Gloucestershire, hope I said that right, which was, you know, Alfred Potter's father, Levi Potter, was the licensee of the Ligon Arms in Chipping Camden, and it was confirmed that there were no such debts. Fabian also asked for inquiries to be made at the Ministry of Agriculture and Fisheries about the result of a test wages investigation made on January 12, 1945 at Furs Farm by Inspector R.G. Elliott, who was apparently reluctant to reveal the information to Fabian without authority from his headquarters. Potter's suggestion that he might occasionally pay Walton for hours he had not worked was disproved by an examination of the sums he had intended for wages from L.L. Potter & Company and those he had paid to Walton. In reality, Potter was claiming more than he needed to pay his employee, and he was pocketing the difference. So Fabian's comment was that Potter, by his own admission, is guilty of claiming more wages than were due, and there is no doubt that he was making a good thing out of Walton's employment by him. Then we fast forward about a month on March 20th at the inquest on Charles Walton. Again, in his initial crime report, Fabian recorded that Potter had told the coroner that he had seen someone in shirt sleeves in his field at 12:30 p.m. and that they were stationary. So as you can see, a lot of shit going on with Alfred Potter here, man. So let's take another little break before we start talking about some myths. You guys know the routine. We'll be back here in a few minutes. You can hit the fast forward button or take this time to take a break. I'll see you back here in a few. So, some of these myths. First one is Ann Tennant was murdered in the same way as Walton. The claims that Ann was pinned to the ground with a pitchfork or slashed with a billhook are pure invention. She was attacked in the view of several witnesses, and the only similarity with Walton's murder was the fact that a pitchfork was used in both instances. Now, I will openly admit, I'm not 100% sure that is actually a myth, because the information that I stated above about that James fucking Hayward guy, those were legitimate quotes from the newspaper or Telegraph, whatever you want to call it, from back in the day. And a lot of them were direct quotes from James Hayward himself and also people who were in court and shit. So I'm 50-50 on whether or not that's actually myth, but I still had to put it out there because somebody apparently thinks it's pure invention, but there's literally newspaper fucking evidence and James Hayward himself saying like what he did. Another one is Walton was the boy in the story of the black dog. There is no evidence that the Charles Walton mentioned in Bloom's book was one and the same as the murdered Charles Walton. The latter had three older sisters and two younger brothers. If the Charles Walton in the story was the same person as the murder victim, he would need to have a sister who died during 1885. However, his sisters Mary Ann and Martha Walton both married in 1891 and lived for some years thereafter, while Harriet, who was Charles's half-sister, was still alive in 1901. Consequently, the story must have been related to another Charles Walton, unless Emma, his mother, gave birth to a fourth daughter between the April 1881 census and the end of 1885. I will say that particular couple paragraphs there, I can't remember exactly where I got that information. I'll be perfectly honest with you because I have a fuckload of sources, but there is no source cited for that information. They do cite a census record. They do say in 1841, in that census, it was taken on June 7th, 1841. It conveniently records Charles's mother as being just 9 months old, implying that she was born around August or September of 1840. In April of 1881, she would have been almost 41 years old without having given birth, at least to the oldest child, for some 5 or 6 years. It is highly unlikely that she did so during the next 5 years, especially since a detailed study of the birth, marriage, and death records held by the Office for National Statistics has failed to produce any likely Walton births or deaths being registered in the Shipson or Stratford-upon-Avon areas during this period. Again, they are citing a census, but the source for that information in particular is not cited. So it's basically like I could fucking write a few paragraphs and say something is not true and not cite my source and just say, no, there's a census here, which you can fucking look up the census. That's not the issue. But how do I explain this? You guys are understanding what I'm saying, I hope. Like, they're saying it's bullshit, and they're citing a census, but they're also saying, okay, like, it's highly unlikely. It could have happened. She could have had another kid. There could have been another child in those 5 years. We're not 100% sure, but according to census records, they don't show up. You know what? Census records are not fucking that accurate, dude. Like, they can be, depending on where you're at, what the year was, and all that shit. I don't ever do a census. Fuck those people. I never fill out a census record, ever. Like, I'm a ghost out here, man. But anyway, I just had to state that. Another one is that Walton was murdered close to a Druid stone circle in a ceremony. Fabian stated in his book, Fabian of the Yard, "One of my most memorable murder cases was at the village of Lower Quinton, near the stone Druid circle of the Whispering Knights. There, a man had been killed by a reproduction of a ceremony on St. Valentine's Eve." Gerald B. Gardner stated in his book, The Meaning of Witchcraft, that the Whispering Knights are not a circle. They are about 12 miles away as the crow flies from Lower Quinton. Nor was Charles Walton killed on St. Valentine's Eve. And as no one knows for certain just what the Druid ceremonies were, it is impossible to say that his death was a reproduction of one. Apart from these details, the description is accurate. Another myth, supposedly, is that Fabian met a wall of silence over the crime. The police took numerous statements from individuals, and while Fabian was happy in later years to suggest that he had met a wall of silence, the most he would say in 1945 was that the natives of Upper and Lower Quinton and the surrounding district are of a secretive disposition and they do not take easily to strangers. But, you know, the truth may be that no one had seen anything and they really didn't have anything to fucking say. But there are other statements that I, you know, had said, you know, towards the, in the investigation part of the episode. I mean, you know, I come from a small town. You know, if somebody from a huge city came questioning us, yeah, we ain't gonna say shit neither, you know. I can understand the vulnerability parts, like a nice old man, everybody respected him, but if there really was a third of the village that believed that he was a witch and somebody was doing good, trying to get him better crops, you know, I don't know. I guess you just never know. You know, maybe Alfred Potter took it upon himself and said, fuck it, I'm just gonna do everybody a favor, you know. Or he owed him money or something, I don't know. Because, I mean, the fact that Alfred Potter, too, is, like, claiming more money from the company and pocketing the difference just because tends to make me think that he might have had some fucking debts somewhere. But when they did the inquiries, there's no debts, but that was all the paper. You know, that was all through the banks. There's no debts through the banks or on paper. You know, this dude could fucking owe money two villages away for gambling or, you know, whatever the case might be. And obviously that's speculation on my behalf, but you guys get the point. So, final thoughts here. As the inquiry drew to a close, Fabian took one last walk up the hill to the site of the murder. And he recalled in his memoirs that it was a bleak and lonely place. Now, reluctantly, Fabian and Webb returned to London, and they were no closer to figuring out who murdered Charles Walton. And every modern police method had been used, but it seemed that Britain's best detective had been beaten by a seemingly motiveless killing. And the inquest on Charles Walton gave the cause of death as murder by person or persons unknown, and he was buried in the churchyard at Lower Quinton. The churchyard was recently landscaped and the headstones removed, so that now there is no trace of Charles Walton at all. And the events of February 1945 have pretty much all been forgotten. Now, long after the case was forgotten, Superintendent Alex Spooner continued his own personal hunt for the killer. He remained convinced that the killer was a local man and soon became a familiar figure in the village. Every year on the anniversary of the murder, Spooner would climb to the scene of the crime and then walk around the village hoping to find a clue that had been missed before. And even after his retirement from the force, he continued to visit the village in the hope that maybe one of those days the killer would just make a mistake and give himself away. As of today, Charles Walton's murder remains unsolved and is likely to remain unsolved. The debate is still open as to whether the crime was an occult ritual, a witchcraft killing, or just an argument over money that got out of hand. And perhaps it is fitting to leave the last word to the celebrated investigator, Robert Fabian, who ultimately tried but failed to crack this case. And he said, "I advise anybody who is tempted at any time to venture into black magic, witchcraft, shamanism, call it what you will, to remember Charles Walton and to think of his death, which was clearly the ghastly climax of a pagan rite. There is no stronger argument for keeping as far away as possible from the villains with their swords, incense, and mumbo jumbo. It is prudence on which your future peace of mind and even your life could depend." And that was in his book, The Anatomy of Crime. If you guys want to read some good fucking detective shit, get that book. Get Robert Fabian, The Anatomy of Crime. Because this dude legitimately was a badass detective. And it's definitely well worth the read. So if you go to visit the village today, You can't help but notice the older residents are still reluctant to talk about Walton's death. And some of those that will talk suggest that a cover-up may have taken place. And, you know, there's certainly the suggestion that some people know more than what they will admit. But I don't think we'll ever really know the truth. But with all of that being said, it's a good long episode to kick off 2024. It's good to be back behind this microphone again. 2023 fucking sucked. So we're back, hopefully kicking ass, doing some different types of cases. Let me go off through some sources here real fast. We have a Medium article called A Murder on Valentine's Day, written by Elizabeth Melville. We have True Crime Detective, article written by Michael East. We have the StratfordHerald.com, article written by Gil Sutherland, published in October of 2021. We have Charles Walton, 50 Years On, by Adrian Pengelly, published in 1995. We have Unsolved Mysteries, The Folk Murder of Charles Walton. And we also have the Metropolitan Police File. All right, I guess. I'm not going to read reviews. I did notice that I got a couple new good ones, and those are appreciated. Always appreciated. It helps other people find me. Like I always say, man, you know, even if you don't want to join Patreon, whatever else, you know, word of mouth. You know, if you listen to an episode one of your friends might like or something like that, just be like, hey, check this out. I did have somebody recently, like a few months ago, leave another bad review about, you know, my language. Dude, just fucking stop. Like, I literally tell you in the podcast description what's going on. You know, like, get your shit together. You know, the fucking mouth breathers out here. Anyway. Ways you can reach me, justin.mcpodcast@gmail.com. You can search Mysterious Circumstances on TikTok. You can find me there. You can search that same thing on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, literally all over the place. Just type in Mysterious Circumstances Podcast. I am not hard to find, you guys. I suppose with all that behind us, me talking for about an hour and a half straight, my voice is about shot for the night. Until next time, I will see you folks on the flip side.